students attending the medical facilities because it's also a university hospital. So it's part of dry season and also mitigating the traffic control that will occur after Labor Day. I have with me Paul Gornick, who is the City of Portland Transportation Project Manager for this project. He can tell you briefly about what we've been doing to outreach to the Markham Hill people.
Fortunately, an existing body, the Markham Hill Transportation Partnership, was already in existence. That's made up of the three institutional partners, hospital partners on the Hill, OHSU, the VA Medical Center, and the Shriners Hospital, as well as Homestead Neighborhood Association up on the Hill. And we've met with them three times so far, I believe, and we planned, we've scheduled weekly meetings with that group to work with them on communications. Because this short time frame to get information out, the PIOs in PBOT have been kind of overwhelmed, so we have hired a consultant off of our flexible service contract list to assist us with communications. And the first piece, Cheryl Cook did a press release yesterday informing about the road closure on the 11th. And we intend to get a mailer out this week, a carrier route mailer, thanks to the help from our partners at the U.S. Postal Service, to get information out to the neighbors on the Hill. OHSU has started working with their staff to make themselves available of the parking in the South Waterfront area, a couple of temporary parking lots, and utilization of the tram to get some of their staff to work. And over the next few weeks, we expect, or the next week and a half, we expect to get a number of other things in place to address the traffic circulation concerns. So that's kind of a work in progress right now.
Okay. It's we're fortunate to have the transportation coordination group in place. That's great. Initial council discussion?
Could I follow up on what you just said about parking in South Waterfront? There was a lot that used to be used down there that now has the sign on it.
Block 33?
Block 33?
Yeah, it's a couple blocks south of the OHSU and tram building.
And my understanding is that once upon a time was available for people to park after hours or something?
I'm not exactly sure of that. OHSU has requested that PBOT contact Bureau of Development Services, which we have done, and have got an allowance of temporary use of that lot with certain conditions for the duration of this project, expected to be 7 or 8 weeks.
So my only suggestion is, since I was down there the other day and saw the sign and the sort of community petition, I would urge you to if you haven't already, just talk to the affected community there, because that's been a flashpoint in terms of their desire to have that lot open.
They've desired to use that lot for commercial purposes, I understand.
Yeah. And under this proposal, would residents down there be able to park on that lot?
I think it would be just limited to OHSU staff is the intent, with a OHSU parking sticker.
And how about after hours?
Well, the sign intended to be only including OHSU staff, and I understand that they intend to start doing some staggered work shifting, so I think it's only going to be available for OHSU staff at this time.
So I'm just, Mayor, I just want to flag this issue because a number of people have brought it to our attention. It's difficult to park, as you know, in that area after hours, which I think is probably having a negative impact on the commercial businesses that are trying to make it, and perhaps there's a win-win here where on off hours, it might be available to the community for people who are coming to go to a restaurant or shop, and at least we could explore that.
So let's explore that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Did you have more? Commissioner?
Is Campus Drive still going to be open?
Campus Drive will still be open, and the that'll be the principal location of a flagging operation, which will occur about 13 or 14 hours of the day, which turns out to be about a third of the project expense is flagging costs.
Why is flagging needed on Campus Drive?
Because coming down Campus Drive, there's only two lanes of traffic, and when someone desires to make a left turn to Trevor Licker Boulevard northbound, it backs cars up into the campus area, and no one can make a right turn onto Terwilliger and whatnot. We'll have three flaggers there to function as a temporary signal
at that intersection.
At that location.
Yeah, that makes sense. Having done both of those routes hundreds of times when I was working up on the hill, what's the nature of the repairs? Is there any possibility of putting a sidewalk on Stem Jackson Park Road as part of this project?
We did look into that concept, but that would require a massive amount of overhanging over the cliff edge, which is into a C-zone, a conservation zone, which would have prolonged the design review process, perhaps with a public process, which would have prevented us from doing the repairs this summer, which is the primary objective of saving the hill.
Right. One of my staff wrote in my notes, we understand the gravity of the situation, which I don't know if that was intended to be funny, but I find it so.
Gravity.
So I do respect that we're doing a different kind of contracting process and the need to get this done before the hill falls down. I'm wondering if, as you continue on, that could be thought of as a preparing for there to be a sidewalk in the future on that particular street.
I can look at the transportation system plan and see what we have in mind for that roadway and then bring that up with the planner and responsible and visit with you.
I think it's a great suggestion. I think part of what the commissioner is getting at is build the retaining wall or something that leaves open a ability of future decision makers to add a sidewalk, because you know how this goes. If we don't think about it a little bit ahead of time, then it's impossible later. Mm-hmm. To do it, not from a conservation zone, just like from an engineering perspective.
I understand.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good. Thank you.
One of my coworkers actually fell off his bicycle as a result of getting into that rut, so I certainly understand the need for the pavement improvements, but there's also a crucial need for a sidewalk or some kind of safe way to walk from the hill down.
And I'll just take a quick poll of, inspired by your comments, just a quick poll of council. I mean, I think that this is a pretty rare opportunity, and we'd be willing to waive, it's a lawyer thing, we'd be willing to waive and fast-track whatever you need in terms of conservation zones, whatever. We all believe in that, but I think having a sidewalk on this road would, of a certain width, would trump that. Again, if that screws up the engineering and makes it prohibitively expensive, that's another matter.
I'm not sure we're actually allowed to waive the conservation zone, but I think we could expedite.
I think there are emergency. There are some emergency.
Yeah.
There are emergency provisions that do allow, as long as you maintain standard improvements, and as long as you're still in the right of way, to encroach on conservation.
Right.
So long, but.
Well, look,
it depends on the emergency scenario. Also,
I really appreciate the willingness to look at it.
All right, is there anyone that wishes to testify on Emergency Ordinance 678?
We had one person sign up, Latoya Fick.
Welcome.
Hello, I'm Toya Fick. I'm here on behalf of OHSU. We've been working pretty closely with PBOT over the last few weeks to prepare for this closure, and we want to thank them for moving so swiftly to address these issues. As you've heard, Stem Jackson Park Road is the primary access route to OHSU, and its closing will have a huge impact on the campus. OHSU is one of two Level 1 trauma centers in the state. That means we're one of two places that can handle the most severe emergencies at any time. So preserving access for our patients is our top priority throughout this closure. To do so, we are working to keep as many employees as possible from driving to the hill. We're encouraging staff to work remotely if they can, take public transportation. We have a great system here in Portland. There are other ways to get to the hill other than driving, so take public transportation. And again, to park on the south waterfront, which you just discussed. We think these three methods will dramatically reduce the number of people who actually drive to the hill, which will save access to our patients. So thanks again to PBOT, and thank you all for taking the time to talk about this today.
Thanks
for taking any questions.
Well, thanks. I just want to thank you and the others and the leadership team at OHSU of working with us on this. We really appreciate your partnership. We're in this
Absolutely.
Together.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Carla, can you please call the vote on 7678?
Fish.
Aye.
Leonard.
Aye.
Fritz.
Well, the issue of parking in South Waterfront and the tram and other such things has been something I've been interested in for a long time. I greatly appreciate the mayor's willingness to look at adding value in this project as he does in so many others.
Adams.
I appreciate you raising it. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 679?
Accept the Oregon Department of Transportation acknowledgement of the city certification to manage certain federal aid capital improvement projects and adopt the city quality control plan for certification projects.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I'm Greg Jones with the Portland Bureau of Transportation. With me are Catherine Levine from the Portland Bureau of Transportation and Beth Vargas Duncan from the Oregon Department of Transportation. With a little background, the purpose of this ordinance is to adopt a quality control procedure for our certification program for how we manage and construct projects with federal funds provided by the Federal Highway Administration. And in addition to that, we have a letter that Beth will present to the council that certifies the Portland Bureau of Transportation and the city to manage federally funded projects. And I'd like to give you a little background on this. So starting in the early 90s, and really with discussion, and then later in 2000, I began a discussion with ODOT about a way to create a more efficient way to manage federally funded transportation projects. At that point, ODOT was responsible for awarding, bidding, and constructing all projects with federal transportation funds on them that were awarded to the city of Portland. And it was a lengthy process, and there was a lot of confusion about, you know, whose project it was, how it was managed, and there was a lot of time involved in that. There was a lot of interest on the part of ODOT, Federal Highway Administration, and the city to find a way to keep projects on schedule, to get the federal funds obligated in a timely way, and to get the cost and time loss addressed in an efficient manner. With the guidance of John Gernhauser, who is now retired with Federal Highway Administration, Christine and Leon and I proceeded with developing a process to allow the city to advertise, bid, and award federally funded construction projects using our procurement methods here at the City of Portland and using our specifications. I think we're the only one in the state that has really developed this system. Others are proceeding forward. Eugene, Corvallis are proceeding forward, but they're using ODOT's procedures. So this has a potential for a huge savings to the city, and we've done a number of test projects that have proved that out. So I'd like to turn this over to Catherine, who can describe what we've done since 2005 as we've moved forward with our test projects.
Great. In 2005, City Council authorized an intergovernmental agreement with the Oregon Department of Transportation to authorize us to participate in the certification program. So since that time, we've completed 13 projects. We have three more under construction and just opened bids on the last test project. Conditional certification, as Greg mentioned, has allowed the City of Portland to design, add, bid, and award, and then directly manage the construction projects. Without certification, this would have been done by the Oregon Department of Transportation. Some of the most recently completed certification projects were those funded by ERA federal stimulus dollars. So the repaving of Madison, Hawthorne, 39th Cesar Chavez, the Portland Bicycle Boulevard project, the Southwest and East Portland Infill Sidewalk Project, the repaving of the Springwater Trail. Those were all ERA-funded projects, and our ability to meet the very tight delivery timelines under the federal law was in large part due to the certification program and working with ODOT through that to deliver those projects on time. The city's graduation to date means that we've completed the test phase and that ODOT is delegating authority to the city through PBOT to administer future FHWA projects in the city that are not on the national highway system. While the city will have more direct management and oversight of these federal projects, ODOT retains full authority in four key areas. That is program funding, environmental clearances, civil rights compliance, and right-of-way acquisition, real estate transactions. Those are not areas that are delegated to local jurisdictions. So the city's commitment today is to continue to comply with all federal requirements and with state oversight. And as part of that compliance, today this ordinance, the passage of this ordinance, would adopt the city's quality control plan for when the bureaus are working on federal aid FHWA-funded certification projects.
So allegorically, this has been a long, long road for me personally and for, I think, the city and for ODOT. And I'd like to thank Federal Highway Administration. I'd like to thank Beth. I'd like to thank Marty Anderson with ODOT's local government section. Christine Leone, who played a major role along with me and in developing these new ideas. We also had participation from Jeff Baer, Jim Van Dyke, Brian Oberding within the city, from Mark Foster, from Riyadh Al-Arithi, and and of course the Federal Highway Administration folks, John, Jeff Graham, and Mike Morrow. This is a big cultural change. It probably to 90% of the public means nothing, but for us in the business, this is a major change in how we do work and how we do work well. And I just want to make sure that it's understood that we were very grateful to all those people for making it happen. With that, I'd like to introduce Beth, who has a letter from the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation for you.
Mayor Adams, members of the council, as Greg mentioned, I'm Beth of Argus Duncan. I'm the certification program manager at ODOT, and I've only been with ODOT about 5 years as certification program manager. So this effort predates me, but I was brought on to help enhance the program, develop it. We have all grown together through this. It's been quite a process. I really want to mention I spoke with Mike Morrow and others at FHWA yesterday. They regret that they cannot be here in person. And also Matt Garrett, our director at ODOT, all of them really wish to extend their congratulations to the city. This is a monumental achievement to transition out of our pilot test phase into full certification for the areas of design, ad bid and award, and construction contract administration. So in the letter that's Catherine is being distributed, I just want to summarize quickly that Portland is only the second city in Oregon to transition out of the test phase. Corvallis just edged you out just within months. And we have Eugene, Clackamas County, Multnomah County, Linn County, and others that are coming on. They're in the test phase right now, and then there's several others coming along just starting into the test phase, City of Salem, Marion County, Lane County. So just in quick conclusion here, I just really want to thank your staff. They've done an outstanding job, been very committed, helped us think out of the box, start new ideas to get ODOT employees and staff to think differently. We deliver very large state projects well, and I think it's really great when a community can gather and deliver their size projects to fit their community appropriately, and that's really our main intention with the program. So we look forward to a long-lasting relationship in the future as we deliver federal aid projects together. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone signed up to testify?
No one else signed up.
Anyone wish to testify? Any discussion from council? Carla, can you please call the vote?
Fish?
Congratulations, and thank you for the presentation. Aye.
Leonard?
Thank you for the good work. Aye.
Fritz.
Thank you, and congratulations, Mayor Adams. Just a sentence from this letter from ODOT. I commend your staff for its outstanding expertise, professionalism, and tenacity resulting in this successful transition. Aye.
Adams.
The best local transportation department in the nation. Thank you for your great ongoing work. You're right, it's not something that most people will know, and I guarantee it will not be in the Oregonian tomorrow. But it's a big deal. So thank you. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for and call the vote for second reading item number 680?
assess benefited properties for street improvements in the Southeast 131st Avenue Local Improvement District. Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Approved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 686?
Amend contract with S. Brooks and Associates for temporary recreation services for $2,700,000 for the period of July 1, 2011 through March 22, 2014.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Christine Moody is here to present. Christine, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Christine Moody, Procurement Services. Today, you have before you an ordinance recommending an amendment to the S. Brooks and Associates contract to allow for an additional 3 years for temporary recreation staff for Portland Parks and Recreation. The estimated amount for the three-year extension is $2.7 million. Brooks and Associates is a locally based temporary services firm that is certified by the state of Oregon as a minority-owned business. They have a strong recruiting strategy in the local community that helps to develop a diverse applicant pool for the city. In 2003, S. Brooks & Associates was the lowest bidder on a city-issued solicitation. In 2009, through the strategic sourcing program, the city directly renegotiated the contract and was able to obtain cost savings by reduced overhead costs of 7%, or approximately $25,000 per year. In June 2010, City Council approved a one-year extension of this contract in order to allow Portland Parks and the advisory group to address specific issues surrounding the use of temporary employees for work that is needed. At this point, I'll turn it back over to Council.
Discussion from Council? Okay, do we have people signed up to testify?
We do. We have one person, Richard Beadle.
Mr. Beadle?
Buzz, congratulations on your resounding victory.
Well, thank you.
I understand you just reelected to another three-year term.
Yeah, and it's going to be a good one. I'm sure of it. Mayor Sam Adams, commissioners, I appreciate the opportunity to address this issue. I represent some of the hardest working folks in the city of Portland, 600 of them. They do most of the maintenance of the city in three different bureaus. And Parks is one of the bureaus that we do the maintenance work in. We have a concern for this contract because basically, from our perspective, this contract is basically in place just to avoid the 1,200-hour rule and to be an avenue to bring cheap labor into providing services in the city of Portland. Parks management actually agrees with this assessment. This is really driven home if you look at the Lisa Turple letter. And it was a memo written to Commissioner Fish by Lisa in March 2nd of 2009. The name of the memo was "The Business Case for the Use of Temporary Staffing Services for Recreation Employees." Turple stated that the city could not afford city employees' wages and benefits at current funding levels, and so it created a need for Brooks. The Bureau now argues that Brooks also brings vital flexibility to certain classifications in the city. Now, this is a legitimate concern. And I am convinced that we, working with BHR, could work together to provide that flexibility in that contract through use of Schedule A premiums and well-written job descriptions to provide job classifications that have the flexibility that is needed to provide these services. There is no reason except for budget reasons and budget concerns why we can't do this. The proposal by BHR to extend the Brooks contract for 3 years also contains a proposal to create full-time and seasonal job opportunities in the city of Portland to replace the job listed classifications in the Brooks contract. Customer service, front desk, building attendants, technicians, fitness room attendants, personal trainers. And I to commend Commissioner Fish for his hard work of minimizing the use of this contract and identifying these job descriptions in order to bring them into the city and to create city opportunities for these people. While we fully support HR and are committed to work with them in a collaborative process to add the needed flexibility to make these new classifications really work for the city, the current proposal of a 3-year contract falls short of our original goal, which was to get this contract out of my jurisdiction. And even worse, BHR plans on continuing the use of temporary services, Brooks, to contract out the following jobs: aquatics and instructors, and for an indefinite period of time, way beyond the 3-year extension. This is not all right. We can do better than this. Permanent employment would meet the city's need for these classifications, these work units, to be reliable, highly trained, skilled, and certified. From what I understand, BHR thinks these classifications are problematic. I have, 483 has not come to that conclusion. After all, we have not had a chance to work with BHR to find out what they're basing those conclusions on. We in 483 are looking forward to working with BHR to help create the flexibility and the job classifications to bring this work in-house. Local 43 is interested in determining whether a full-time permanent classification may be made if the seasonal nature of the work can be accommodated, or if we need limitation of hours to do this work. That's not been determined, but we look forward to working with BHR to make that determination. If progress is being made on these classifications and we're working together to bring this work in-house, then 483 would be amenable to extending this temporary contract for another year, for even 2 years. We just need these. That's why we're making a 1-year proposal here, is because we need to look at this on a yearly basis to hold each other accountable to make progress on this effort. We have no desire to break the system. We just want to do what's right by these employees and what's right by the boys who are providing these services. They have a right to be treated with the same status and respect that every other public employee providing services in the city of Portland now enjoys. Now more than ever, we need to offer the community as many living wage, fully benefited job opportunities as possible. We have a middle class crisis in this city. Middle class jobs are rapidly disappearing, being replaced by part-time, low-wage, no-benefit jobs. Every day I meet skilled workers who would jump at the opportunity to have a career with the city of Portland. We have an opportunity here to create 60 good middle class jobs with good benefits. I just don't understand why we don't jump at this chance. This is a real jobs program. This is probably the cheapest job program that we could have. HR is proposing and definitely keeping the Brooks contract for aquatics and instructions with a cap of 20 people. The total difference in a cost of 20 rec leaders versus 20 Brooks workers is only $156,000. We can give living wage opportunities.
I need you to wrap up.
Okay.
I've given you way more time, and you're repeating yourself now.
Well, we can do this for $7,800 per person. If you're serious about creating jobs, this is a cheap way of doing it. Thank you.
Give you 6 minutes. Thanks.
Was it really?
Thanks.
I had it timed. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, am I done? Okay.
That's all who signed up.
Any initial discussion before we move to a vote? All right, Carla, can you please call the vote?
Fish?
Well, first, I want to thank Buzz and 483 for the partnership that we enjoy on this and many other issues. When I became commissioner in charge of the Parks Bureau, and Buzz and I had one of our first meetings, he raised with me the question of the Brooks staffing contract. As my colleagues know, this issue had been previously litigated through the Employment Relations Board and other forums, and the city's reliance on temporary workers through that program had been upheld as lawful and as contractual. But based on my conversations with Buzz and the questions that he raised about modifications to our existing practice, I agreed to a new approach. And that new approach was to do what we all aspire to up here, which is to engage our labor partners in a dynamic discussion about alternatives. That conversation has been very productive. And it has led to some very productive suggestions that have come out of the Labor Management Committee process. We take them very seriously, and I am working closely with Bureau of Human Resources to respond to those concepts. I want to respond to a couple things Buzz said, just as I want the record to be clear. Yes, we have reduced our reliance on this program, and he acknowledged that. I believe we were once over 100 people. We're now below 50. As the ordinance indicates, we've also brought down our costs. We're spending less on this program. And as I said earlier, because of the relationship that we have with our labor partners on this and many other issues, we welcome the chance to discuss a new path, a new way of doing business. And so we will continue to have those discussions. On the concern that was raised about the three-year term, let me assure my friend, Buzz Beadle, that this particular agreement can be terminated by either party upon 30 days' notice. So let's be clear. The 3 years is a ceiling, an absolute outside ceiling. I believe that based on the progress we've made so far, I'd be shocked if we can't resolve this in less than 3 years. But I do appreciate the spirit of collaboration which led to these discussions, and I think they're important discussions, and we have shared values around providing meaningful work employment opportunities for people. So I thank you, Buzz, for your testimony. Glad to sort of clear up a couple of the points on the record. And I want to thank Christine Moody and Margaret Evans, the dynamic team at HR, and my staff for all the hard work they put into this. This particular matter goes into the thickest file in my office, which is no good deed goes unpunished. But we are embarking on this because this commissioner believes it's the right thing to do. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
I have great respect for Mr. Brooks and his agency, and I will vote aye on this ordinance. I'm very glad to hear, Commissioner Fish, that you're willing to continue to work with Laborers 483. This is an emergency and does need to be passed today. These workers work more than 1,200 hours per year, some full-time, yet receive none of the city benefits that those working next to them receive. And I agree with the concerns raised that this could be a very good job creation opportunity as we continue to climb out of the recession and start hopefully having more opportunities. I was glad to see that the hiring freeze is coming off as of June 30th, that we want to have more opportunities and more equity in who gets to apply for city jobs, who gets those city jobs. And these are some of the jobs that start at the bottom of the ladder and hopefully could work up into some of the more into leadership positions, as indeed has been done in the past. So I appreciate this conversation. Aye.
Adams.
Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 687?
Adopt Bureau of Technology Services Administrative Rule 1.07 on technology project oversight to create a citizen committee, affirm the importance of quality assurance for technology projects, and outline the responsibilities of the Office of Management and Finance.
Mr. Granke.
Good morning, Mark Granke. I'm the city's chief technology officer. I'm here today at council's direction to bring forward an ordinance which sets in motion the creation of a technology oversight committee. This committee will be comprised of five city council appointed citizens whose role will be to provide independent oversight on those technology projects which present significant risk to the city's financial and operational practices. On April 13th, City Council adopted amendments to City Code establishing the authorities of the Technology Oversight Committee. BTS Administrative Rule 1.07 therefore provides the policy that guides how projects will be reviewed and evaluated by that committee. Additionally, this rule establishes that those projects will also be monitored for quality assurance through services provided by an independent quality assurance firm. This rule has completed its review and comment period and is now ready for council consideration. The committee will be assembled following council adoption. With me here today is Jane Brayton. She's the OMF Business Operations Division Manager, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have.
Discussion with counsel. Anyone wish to testify in this matter? Carla, can you please call the vote on this emergency ordinance?
Fish?
I was previously briefed on this. I thank you for your good work in moving forward with the implementation plan. I was happy to be able to designate someone to serve on the project, on the citizen committee, and all of us up here have bureaus that from time to time have computer upgrade and assist IT upgrade projects, which I think we'll all benefit from this new oversight panel. Thank you. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Thank you for your work. Aye.
Adams?
Great work. Thank you both. Aye. So approved. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 688?
Approve an 18-year tax exemption extension requested by the Hazelwood Group Limited Liability Company for the 96 affordable units and the prorated portion of parking in the multi-unit housing development on 11933 Northeast Davis Street, known as the Hazelwood Retirement Community.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. This is the first of two matters that we'll be bringing before council this morning. I don't know that we'll need the full 30 minutes, but I'm delighted to introduce the distinguished director of the Portland Housing Bureau, Margaret Van Vliet, and Kate Allen, who are here to make a brief presentation and walk you through any questions you may have. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning again. I'm Margaret Van Vliet, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. This is a request to extend limited tax abatement exemption on parts of the property, and Kate's going to walk you through it in a minute. The context I will set for you is simply just to remind you that you charged the Portland Housing Bureau a couple of years ago now with the job of streamlining the process, of looking at policies to make sure that they're in alignment with current direction of both the city and the county, and to sort of clean up and make sure that we're implementing the limited tax exemptions consistent with code. And so we're deep in that process, not quite through with it yet. With respect to this project and a couple of others that have come through recently, kind of midway through our process, I want to underscore that the Planning and Sustainability Commission and the Portland Housing Bureau senior staff are both very much in alignment with the recommendation from staff today. It's certainly fair to acknowledge that the owner, who's represented today and I expect may want to testify, has requested a different approach. So we're going to walk you through our analysis and the reason for our recommendation, and then we'd be happy to answer any questions. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kate Allen.
Thanks. Kate Allen, Housing Policy Manager for the Portland Housing Bureau. As Director Van Vliet said, ordinance before you today to approve an 18-year tax exemption extension for the 96 affordable units in the Hazelwood Retirement Community is consistent with the priorities identified with the county and other partners in the ongoing Big Look tax exemption review process co-chaired by Commissioner Fish. That emphasis on creating and preserving affordability and careful stewardship of the investment of foregone revenue through the limited tax exemption programs. The recommendation before you is consistent with the language in the Transit-Oriented Development Limited Tax Exemption Program Code for the city and in the state statute, which anticipates the potential of extending a 10-year exemption if financial need is demonstrated for the units in a development which are subject to a public assistance contract to provide low-income housing. There are two regulatory agreements in effect for the Hazelwood Station project, the Portland Housing Bureau agreement that expires in 2028 and the Oregon Housing and Community Services agreement that expires in 2029.
Can I just jump in on one thing because just to make sure because that's a complicated piece, but the plain English on that is that those are our assurances, those are our insurance policies that the units that we're abating will remain affordable and meet our requirements for the duration of the tax abatement. So that's the prerequisite to be eligible for this extension.
Thank you. The project that we're talking about, the Hazelwood Retirement Community, is the upper three stories of a four-story structure over a 35,000-square-foot rectangular site, which is part of a 17-acre mixed-use shopping center with Safeway and Target as the anchor department stores. The project is located three blocks from 122nd Avenue and the East Burnside Max Light Rail Station and includes 120 units of congregate housing for people 62 years of age or older. The unit mix includes 28 studios, 68 one-bedrooms, and 24 two-bedroom apartments. The Portland...
Congregate mean again?
Congregate is some level of service for the residents who are there. Portland Housing Bureau financial analysis finds that the exemption recommended is necessary and that, in fact, the project is still at financial risk due in part to the expense of the operation of this critically important housing model, the congregate care model. As Director Van Vliet noted, the developer has requested exemption for all 120 units. That includes the units that are not restricted on income. But based on our financial analysis and the developer's request, the Portland Housing Bureau staff have initiated work with the developer to both review the Portland Housing Bureau debt structure and to meet with Oregon Housing and Community Services to explore possible remedies with that agency. I want to finish by acknowledging the work of Portland Housing Bureau staff, Comey Calivore, Kim McCarty, and John Marshall.
We're all here in the back.
As well as Uma Krishnan at Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And as Director Van Vliet acknowledged, the developer, Dan Steffi, is here with us as well today. Thank him for his work, and we're happy to answer any questions you might have.
So, as usual, I seek your clarification. And there's a difference between the tax abatement for developing a project, and then there's a different, it's a kind of a different process for establishing that there needs to be an ongoing abatement for running it. Am I understanding that correctly?
That's a process in the case of the transit-oriented development exemption that is described in our code as a limited potential for an extension of the existing exemption.
Authorized under state law. So right. To her question.
So it is not a separate program, it is anticipated within the code for that specific LTE program.
Thank you. And what's the maximum amount, length of time for the abatement?
Both in statute and code, it is not prescribed. The maximum length would be the length of the affordability agreement, the regulatory agreement.
And so that's what we have?
That's what's in front of you, the remainder of the affordability period of 18 years. Correct.
So it's possible that after 18 years it could be converted or it's come back. Could it come back for another abatement after that?
At that point, all of the regulatory agreements requiring its operation as affordable housing will fall away. So it would be...
With one exception, which is since these programs are monitored annually, if at any point the owner-operator does not comply with our program, then the abatement would cease at that point.
Thank you. This in conjunction with the other discussion we had a couple of weeks ago is very helpful.
So I believe Dan Steffi's here. Is anyone else signed up, Carla?
No one else signed up.
Dan, why don't you come up? And if you could stay close so we can answer any questions. Dan, before you get started, can I just make a historical note on something unrelated to this?
Absolutely. I would give you absolute permission to do that.
Thank you. So Dan joined us for the opening of the Bud Clark Commons. And there was a little walk down memory lane that happened at that event. And one of the things that we remarked on was that it was about 25 years ago that Mayor Clark issued his 12-point plan on the homeless, which was a visionary document. And the actual report that accompanied it was called Breaking the Cycle of Homelessness. And Dan, at the time, you were the mayor's chief advisor on those issues, correct?
Correct.
And what I said then and I'll say now is that that document that laid out a comprehensive vision for how to address homelessness, which went past the shelter model to looking at comprehensive services, transitional housing, investment, really sparked a revolution in our community. And to this day, we build on that work. I just want to just acknowledge the foresighted work that you did and Bud did and how proud we are to be able to recognize that legacy in naming the Bud Clark Commons a couple weeks ago.
Well, thank you. I think it was a very fitting honor for the former mayor to have that. And I would love to take 100% of the credit for the 12-point plan, but I couldn't do that without acknowledging the extraordinary contributions of Don Clark, who was then the director of Central City Concern. And he was a great mentor for me and a great, he had very big boot that he applied to Backside whenever he didn't think we were making sufficient progress.
Yeah. And by the way, based on our action, what used to be known as the Clark Center, which was a TPI facility, will now be the Don Clark Center, and to avoid confusion with Bud Clark Commons. Okay. Anyway, welcome.
Thank you. My name is Dan Steffi. I'm a managing member of the Hazelwood Group, LLC. And I really don't have much to add to what staff has presented. I'm content that we have an agreement now to work through the financial issues that might result from not abating 100% of the property. I would point out, however, that this project is unique in several ways. One is that it, as staff has pointed out, it's part of a 17-acre commercial development that at the time we put it together could not have been developed without the housing being part of that component. But the housing and the commercial are in separate ownership. And over the course of the years that the property tax has been abated on this property already, the taxing jurisdictions have collected from that shopping center well in excess of $3 million of property tax revenue that would not have been collected but for the fact that housing is on that site. That said, we're very proud of the services we're providing for our residents, which include three meals a day, housekeeping, all utilities, free cable TV, transportation, exercise. I mean, they get a very, very good place to live with a lot of supportive services that allow them to age in place and not enter more expensive care. And would love to invite you all out to come and visit with the residents and see the facility. The other piece that I want to point out is that this is a bit of a pioneering effort insofar as it is the one of the few residential facilities on top of a big box retail center, particularly outside the downtown core. And it would be wonderful if we could figure out ways to do more of that, but it is very difficult to do. So.
Dan, thank you for your comments, and I also appreciate that Margaret and Kate have said on the record, made the commitment to work with you on the other financial issues that we may be able to influence because we have a community stake in the success of this development, this project. And we have a policy disagreement perhaps as to 24 of the 120 units, and I think it's well grounded in the history and in the direction that we've been given in terms of administering these programs, but that should not obscure the fact that we are united at the hip in terms of trying to help make this pencil out. And you have the commitment of the Bureau that they will work with you and on creative solutions to helping you be financially viable.
I appreciate that. I also recognize that opinions are sort of like noses. Everybody has one, and sometimes they're different. I'm quite committed to working and appreciate that commitment, Commissioner.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is, I don't know how much folks know just how difficult and innovative this particular development and project is. I mean, and outside of the central city, has it been replicated anywhere else in the city? Yeah. So thank you for that. All right. Thank you. Carla, please call the roll. The vote.
Fish.
Mayor and colleagues, with the creation of the new Portland Housing Bureau, a lot of functions that were previously performed by the Portland Development Commission migrated over. There is no function which we take more seriously and that requires more time and effort and care than the administration of our limited tax abatement programs. We are, as Kate mentioned, through a big look process, which we want to gratefully acknowledge Commissioner Fritz's role in that process and Jeff Kogan's role. We are going to be coming forth with some recommendations in the near term as to how to administer them to give taxpayers the maximum bang for their buck and to align them with the core priorities of this council. But I'm very proud of the work that my team does in reviewing these and reporting. Kim, Comey, and John, thank you. And I personally would like to thank you for the memos that you provided counsel. Very clear, answered all of the questions that I had. And I know, Kim in particular, you put a lot of time and energy into that. We appreciate it. And to my leadership team, you know, we're doing more with less right now, and we're going through some very painful reductions. This week, we're saying goodbye to 6 people. We started it when this bureau was launched. We had over 70 employees. We're now something like 56. At the same time that the workflow and the workload, the demands have gone up. You could not ask more of a group of people working under difficult circumstances at a time of cutbacks at the federal and state level. I'm very proud of the work that they do and grateful for their service. Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. Thank you, Commissioner Fish. Can you please read the title for emergency ordinance item number 689?
Authorize a $4 million grant and the transfer of title in real property located at 316 Northwest Gleason Street to the Blanchet House of Hospitality for the development of a facility to house individuals at risk of homelessness and to operate a charitable feeding program.
Commissioner Nick Fish.
Thank you, Mayor. Mayor, we have some good news to share with you this morning. We'll be seeking council authorization to make a modest investment in a project which had already been given the green light by PDC, for which we get a tremendous community dividend. Just by way of background, the Blanchet House transaction predated me on this council, and my colleagues, particularly you, Mayor, and Commissioner Leonard, will remember that this goes back to a community discussion about potentially co-locating a new Blanchet House and a then-proposed resource access center on the same lot. There was some controversy about the co-location in that site, and as a result, a decision was made to move the resource access center, now known as Bud Clark Commons, to Block U, which is adjacent to the bus terminal. This particular project has already been approved in its original form. What is, I think, the good news we're going to share with you today is that an opportunity arose where the city could make a very small investment and get an enormous return on its 10-year plan to end homelessness, and that is to add a fourth floor and some beds. And we are really appreciative of the creativity of the Blanchet House board and the leadership. And I will say that one of the things that makes this particular opportunity especially attractive to the Portland Housing Bureau is that, unlike a lot of our investments where there is also an ongoing exposure on the operating side, we are not assuming any responsibility on the operating side. Blanchet House has a healthy endowment. They have a generous donor base. They run very effective programs. Today we're being asked to make a capital investment to allow them to add a floor and some beds, but they would then take responsibility for managing it. That very rarely happens in our work. So this has multiple dividends, a LEED gold building, urban form at the side of the old Dirty Duck building, and we think it's a heck of an investment for the council. Margaret, why don't you take it over?
Thank you, Commissioner. Mayor Adams and commissioners. I'll try and be brief here, but this is an important transaction, and we want to make sure that you are understanding both the business points and the policy points that we're asking you to endorse here. So again, Blanchet House of Hospitality is a very long-standing, successful nonprofit charitable organization that's been providing transitional housing and meals in Old Town Chinatown for many, many years. We are pleased to have inherited this transaction from the Portland Development Commission and to carry it over the finish line. As Commissioner Fish mentioned, the initial discussions did go back several years. We looked up to get the dates right. Funds were first reserved in the PDC budget back in fiscal year 05-06, and out of the downtown waterfront district then, and with the change in district lines, it's now in the River District. And $2 million in a development and disposition agreement was set aside back in 2008. The siting had been a major source of conversation with the neighborhood. And between, again, Block 25 and Block U. So where it's landed, as Nick has said, is on the site of what is used to be the Dirty Duck, and I think that's what where most people sort of associate with this. I do want to point out, and this is mentioned in your materials, the city actually owns most of that block, and we do have a parking obligation with Northwest Natural that is connected with that site. That's not a Housing Bureau piece of real estate. I believe that's owned otherwise by Facilities and OMF. So what part of the ordinance that you're asked to authorize today gives us, PHB, the option but not the obligation to purchase the current piece of that block where Blanchet sits and will be moved from for a dollar. We're going to decide that later after we understand more fully the city's interests with that real estate, but I did want to point out that that's inside of the business that you're asked to take today. So again, when we inherited the transaction, there was a $2 million commitment. What you're asked to authorize today is increased up to $4 million. We were approached last year by Dan and his team to add the additional $2 million. We do think it's good public value. As you'll note in your materials, it'll be a total of 72 beds. We think that's quite good leverage for our public investment. They've done a really good job with private fundraising and with leveraging new market tax credits. So for the total cost of 13.5, we have just the $4 million investment plus the land. And then the final thing here, again, in terms of business points, is we do not have an ongoing obligation on the operations side, as Commissioner Fish mentioned. The other thing on the policy side, before I turn it over to my Deputy Director, Jacob Fox, what I want to just note is that we did just release the street count to sort of more specifically understand who's homeless in our community, how, what's their profile. And so if you haven't had a chance to see that, I would urge you to take a look at the materials that we've released recently on the street count. In terms of the homeless population, we did see a modest uptick in the number of folks who are literally unsheltered each night. It's that number is now at about 2,700 each night. 73% of those are male, and the rest, of course, are female or transgender. We took some questions from you a week ago about what are we doing with women who have been victims of domestic violence, women generally. And I want to reassure you that we are going to come back with some analysis that ties in our findings from the street count and shows you what are our investments, what's the county do, because you may recall that it's the Multnomah County that has responsibility for servicing victims of domestic violence in the homeless system, whereas we do single adults. It's a kind of an arcane distinction, but the point is I want to make sure that we show you the whole picture. So these 72 beds are going to serve males. We want to acknowledge that you had these questions, and we'll come back and address them in a couple of weeks.
Why was that choice made to make them all male?
Is it?
That's how our models worked for the last 59 years. But I want to point out that we serve men, women, and children on our feeding center. It's open to anyone. We serve the unemployed, the working poor. It's open to everyone, and Central City Concern will tell you we're their primary feeding resource. And so I just want to make it clear we're not solely the housing's man. We did try another facility that we had, co-ed, and it really didn't work out too well. So this is the model we've followed for 59 years at the Blanchet House, and it's the one that's worked.
I was thinking of making them all female since the Resource Access Center, the Bud Clark Commons, is all male. I just wondered if you'd thought about that.
We had considered possibly making it co-ed, but settled on sticking with the model that we've always had. At some point, we may try another facility, but it wouldn't be co-located here.
Jacob?
So I'd just add a few things to Margaret's comments, but I forgot to say it's an honor to be before you, Mayor Adams and Commissioners. So a couple things I'd add. Again, Margaret said that it's LEED Gold. We know that that's important to you as a council, and the developer is committed to that. I would also point out that one of the things that we started at the Bug Clark Commons was an innovative way to improve livability in Old Town through indoor queuing as opposed to outdoor queuing. So as we've all driven by the current Blanchet facility and see the needs there, there is outdoor queuing there. So the new facility does have indoor queuing.